Welcome back to Unyielded, Thriving No Matter What. I'm your host, Bobby Kaler, and I'm so happy that you've joined us. As the creator and host of this podcast, it is critical to me to convey to you, our listeners, how much positive power you have inside of you right now, in this very moment. You have the power to change your life. And that could be changing it, like I had to back when I was 23, from a place of kind of being on a road to nowhere, kind of feeling hopeless and stuck, to being on a road to somewhere desirable, someplace good. It could also be changing your life from good to great. And it could also be changing your life from great to, I cannot believe how incredibly blessed and lucky I am to get to live this life. You have that power inside of you, and that is all you need to get started. The rest, you can learn along the way. I started this podcast as a way to bring stories of hope and triumph, as well as resources that will help you along that journey, whatever that might be, whatever your starting place is, or whatever your destination might be. My sincerest hope is that you find it valuable. So let's go. Here is this week's episode. Before introducing this week's guest, just want to give you a quick reminder that we've launched a new segment of the Unyielded podcast. The new segment is called Rise and Thrive. They come out on Mondays, they're super short, and they are intended to be fuel for you, your week, and your life. So please check them out, and I truly hope that they add value to your week and to your life. My guest today is one of the world's leading specialists on developing and applying emotional intelligence to improve performance. He is the CEO of 6 Seconds, a global nonprofit research organization turning the science of emotional intelligence into practical tools and methods. His research focuses on the factors that enhance individual and team performance. He partners with leaders to identify key relationship and emotional intelligence factors that limit or enhance success. And then he helps organizations implement new systems so that teams can excel and talent thrives. He is also the author of, or co-author of, many books on emotional intelligence, assessments, and learning systems for individuals, professionals, and organizations, including best-selling books like At the Heart of Leadership, How to Get Results with Emotional Intelligence, and Inside Change, Transforming Your Organization with Emotional Intelligence. His purpose is to inspire compassionate wisdom, which he does through speaking, writing, and leadership to blend the power of emotions with rigorous, practical data. We are so lucky to have him on the show today. His name is Josh Friedman, and I cannot wait for you to meet him. Josh, thank you so much for joining me here on the Unyielded podcast.
Thank you, Bobby.
Oh my goodness. I've been looking forward to this, Josh. I love the work that you're doing, but why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what led you to it?
Well, it's been quite a journey over these last 24 years. I was first introduced to this idea of emotional intelligence 30 years ago when I was a teacher, and I was not really interested in emotions. I was interested in academic teaching, and I stumbled accidentally into teaching middle schoolers, and, you know, so 12 to 14 year old, and there's a lot of emotions there.
Oh,
and I just found it was super fun, and it challenged me in ways that was really unexpected. And in this school, there was this premise that emotional development and academic development actually work together.
Wow.
And we had this process in the school called self-science, just using the scientific method to look at yourself and your own emotions. And one of the things that would happen is when kids had an issue with each other or with a teacher, they could call anybody to come into the self-science class to have a conversation. And so I would get pulled into self-science by these, you know, 12, 13, 14 year olds who would then, you know, share their concern and share their feelings. And I'm like, wow, I don't know how to do this.
Wow.
And it was like such an education for me. And what I found is it really shifted my understanding, and I got really interested in this idea. And I think the truth is that I was attracted to this because I was bad at it.
Oh.
I grew up with two statistician parents. I was like very like, let's go do this, make this happen, oriented. I was an entrepreneur. I started three businesses before I was 20. And I remember one time one of my employees was like, well, we should talk about this. And I slammed my hand down. No, we don't need to talk about it. You just need to get the work done. And it's like, oops.
Just knowing you, I cannot imagine you ever doing that. Like, that's the opposite of how, of what I think about when I think about you.
Well, like I said, I've had to learn. So it's been by necessity.
Oh, my goodness. And what a school. I mean, what an experience at that school. That was, I don't think I've heard of another school that operated that way.
Well, it was truly, it was magical.
Yeah.
And adults would come, including Dan Goleman came and visited.
Oh.
And adults would come and visit and they would say, I want to go here.
Yeah.
So Dan Goleman came and visited when he was researching his book, Emotional Intelligence, Why It Can Matter More Than IQ. And he ended up writing a chapter in the book about this self-science methodology. And that's really what led us to start 6 Seconds in 1997.
Wow. That's amazing. So tell us a little bit about 6 Seconds.
Well, first, I'll answer the question. People always want to know, why are you called 6 Seconds?
And
the answer is that emotions at a neurobiological level are chemicals. And these little chemicals go running around in our brains and bodies. If any of you saw that movie Inside Out, you know that picture of these little emotion characters in your brain. Well, they're in your body, in your brain, all over the place. These chemicals are going in there, affecting every living cell in the human body. They're just part of our regulatory system. And they're there, you know, even the CFO is like, just be rational in this really emotional way. Even that character, these emotions are running around. The actual chemicals of emotion last in our brains and bodies for around 6 seconds. And so that's what led us to that. And Candace Pert, one of our advisory board members, who was a real pioneer in the science of emotions, she said, emotions are kind of like keys. And so sometimes we use this, you know, metaphor of a key, and these little keys go kind of running around in our brains and bodies, and they find a receptor site and click, kind of shift that cell. And then they're absorbed and broken down. And then that cell starts producing new chemicals, and we have a cascade effect that can last much, much longer than 6 seconds. But each little bit of chemical. So that means two things. One is, if like me, you see that there's wisdom and value in feelings, you have a little 6 seconds window of opportunity to kind of go, wait, oh, what is that key? You know, what is that about? And the other is, if you are like I used to be and you're like, I don't want these things, you have this little 6 seconds of window of opportunity to say, okay, I'm going to shift this before that cascade effect escalates.
Yeah. Okay, Josh. So that makes me think that's a short window, 6 seconds. That could be the name of a movie, by the way. What do you do to either shift or tap into it? You know, the wisdom and the value.
Well, I think the first thing for me has been to become more comfortable with feelings. And for me, that has meant understanding the logic of emotions more clearly. Mm. And again, I mean, different people come at this in different ways. I come at it from this scientific, rational perspective. And I wanted to understand, you know, in order to kind of deal with this stuff that was overwhelming for me, I wanted to understand it.
Yeah.
And so looking at the neurobiology, looking at theoretical models of emotions has helped me kind of go, okay, they're not irrational. There is a logic to feelings. And I can get this data and I can understand this data and I can find value in it. I said my parents were both statisticians. That's what my dad did. My mom still does. They get data. They get this big data set and they go, okay, what does this tell us? What's the story of this data? What is the meaning? How do we use this to help us in the world?
Yeah.
So that's intelligence. And emotional intelligence is just doing that with emotional data.
Yeah. And I've often, heard it this way, said it this way myself, that emotions, like anger, for example, some people are like, oh, you should never feel anger. And it's like, it's an emotion. It's valid. It's data that something is going on. And I've never, I never really thought about it from the statistician point of view. That's awesome. And the other thing you said there is that you understand the logic of emotions. And so many people would say, well, those are separate.
Yeah.
Either logic. Yeah, it's either or. I love that.
Well, let me just double click on this value in emotions, because I think a lot of managers will say, well, this is business. Let's leave emotions out of it. Let's make a good decision. So two things. The first is, there is no such thing as good decisions without emotions. People who literally have brain illness, which causes them not to be able to feel emotions, they can't make good decisions. Because emotion tells us this is a credible, it's not just an idea, it's a credible idea. This person, they really make sense logically, and I trust them. That trust part is a feeling.
Yes.
And then if you think about this idea, let's leave emotions out of business. What a stupid idea. Let's have no loyalty. That's an emotion or feeling. Let's have no care. Let's have no concern. Let's have no passion. Let's have no joy, wonder, surprise. What they really mean when they say that is, I don't like it when people get upset.
Yeah.
I don't want people mad. It's because I don't know how to deal with it. And I can relate to that. Of course we want trust. Of course we want connection. We need emotions. They're valuable. We just have to have the right way to handle them and use them so that we can move our enterprises forward.
Yeah. I am, and I wrote that down. No such thing as a good decision without emotions. And it's so true. And I never really thought about that. Trust is, that's an emotion. I love that. So how do people get more comfortable with the emotions that make them uncomfortable, if that even makes sense?
Yeah. So again, my kind of lens on this, getting this kind of more rational understanding of feelings. And then I have worked to let go of the idea of positive and negative feelings.
Yes.
Because as soon as you start saying, well, these are negative, or even some people will say bad feelings, there's this great motif in Star Wars where multiple times people will say, I have a bad feeling about this, particularly Han Solo. If there are bad feelings, how do I listen to that? How do I make friends with that?
Yeah.
And so I've tried to do this myself, sometimes less and sometimes more successfully, just to step back and go, no, it's just interesting. There's something going on. And when I have a big feeling, and I don't need to judge it as negative or positive, a big feeling tells me I'm perceiving something big.
Yes.
Right? A big opportunity, a big threat. And now I've been slowly being better able to do that with others. And when I see somebody, like an employee, is having some feelings, instead of going, oh, shoot, there's a problem, there's something bad, I have to react, saying, oh, that's interesting. They're perceiving something.
Yes. That makes me think about kind of what we were talking about before we started recording, when we were talking about, how sometimes people have those moments of self-doubt, and then it's like, and I think it's this rush of like the bad, in air quotes, the bad feelings versus, oh, that's interesting. Perhaps something big, perhaps I'm perceiving something big. And I'm wondering if there's any kind of useful connection there.
Well, I think we have a number of narratives in our world around how things are supposed to be.
Yes. Right?
And so we have a narrative of, the Cinderella story. We have a narrative of the heroic entrepreneur.
Yes.
Right. And so, dear entrepreneur, your journey is you start up in a garage and you're scrappy and you struggle and then you get this break and then you have this great thing and you work hard and take off and you're successful and it's done.
And there's never any backsliding. It's a straight line.
Yeah. So I think those narratives are very far from reality. And when we start experiencing reality and we start saying like, wait, is there something wrong with me that I don't match that narrative? Like, that's what everybody says happens. You know, strong managers are X, successful leaders are Y, and I'm having self-doubt. Now there's something wrong with me. It's like, I'm doubting myself for doubting myself.
What a vicious cycle, you know?
It is. But really what's happening is we're running up against the fact that reality is more complex and more nuanced than these fairy tales.
Yes.
And I get involved in some social entrepreneur projects and some, you know, some programs for transformational leadership. And I often hear speakers talking about this kind of like, okay, you're going to go change the world. And they kind of describe it in this fairy tale path. And I get really worried about people, particularly younger people, who are hearing that and thinking, oh, there's something wrong with me because I have doubt. There's something wrong with me because I got funding and I still don't know if we're on the right path. So I don't know, Bobby, maybe it's just me, but this is my 24th anniversary at 6 Seconds. As one of the founders, and as I've been the CEO for over 10 years now, and there are a lot of days that I wake up and I have that voice in my head saying, who are you to do this? You are crazy. This is impossible. Go get a real job. And these other narratives like man up, stop talking about emotions.
Yes.
And it is, you know, particularly with COVID and in the kind of 18 months of profound uncertainty, but even in other times, it's that fairy tale has not been my experience.
Yeah. I think it's a great point to recognize kind of the fairy tale narrative that we're told, and maybe not from a bad place. Maybe like I think about commencement speakers, right? They're always trying to, we're trying to inspire, but maybe we are setting up the wrong expectation.
Yeah.
You know?
Our brains really like oversimplification.
Yes, they do.
And we get attached to that. It turns out your brain loves certainty. And knowing, like, that's why we get so self-righteous, you know, and we look at, you know, somebody doing something on Facebook that we disagree with and we, like, lose our stuff. They're wrong and they're bad. Like, that self-righteousness actually feels really good for your brain.
Yeah.
It's why changing your mind is so hard.
Right.
It takes work to overcome our own biases. There's a dopamine reward circuit for knowing the answer.
Really?
Yeah. And so when you have that sense of certainty, you're literally giving your kind of dopamine is kind of like heroin. It's an opiate in your brain, naturally produced, but similar in effect. And you get this dopamine reward for like, I know.
Wow.
And by the way, this is fascinating. You also get a dopamine reward for learning and trying something new. But these two paths, it's sort of like, you're walking through the woods and you can kind of go out on your own and, you know, be an entrepreneur and find a new way through the woods. Or you can like follow the policy, right?
Yes.
Do what you're told and follow the known path. They both have a reward circuit. But when we're stressed, guess what happens?
I'm guessing we go to the one that we're most comfortable with.
The known.
The known.
Yeah. And guess who's stressed?
Everyone.
Everyone.
Yeah.
And this is why innovation is so difficult and why emotion is a critical part of innovation and why, you know, good leaders, I'm sure you're familiar with Project Aristotle from Google, and they, you know, they spent millions of dollars, like we could have told them this for like $25, but they spent millions of dollars researching what makes a strong team. And they tried all of these different permutations. And, you know, they're just data junkies there. So they're like, let's measure this and measure this and measure this. What if we get this kind of people together? What if we do this? And there was at the beginning, the assumption was we'll get rock star coders. We'll get super talented people and we'll bring them together and they'll be a strong team. That didn't work.
Mm-mm.
Could have told them that. But what they found at the end was that really, when people feel safe, when people feel heard, when the airtime in a team meeting is shared, when there's healthy debate without being mean to each other, it's like kindergarten stuff, right? But like, you know, so managers who facilitate that kind of connectedness and psychological safety is a, you know, term for it, but like basically people feel emotionally safe. They're able to take more risks. They're able to go on that path through the forest and try something new.
That makes perfect sense. I think about in facilitation, we always talk about having that balance between challenge and support, because if there's not enough support, challenge becomes overwhelming. Too much, and what's the opposite? Too much support, you become complacent and you don't need to learn or anything. Yeah. I love that. So is there anything, Josh, that a person can do in terms of trying something new? I mean, because I love the fact that, and when you said that about the dopamine reward, I was thinking about like, I love cross-country skiing. Mm-hmm. I love it. Okay. And I used to hate going down hills because I grew up in the Midwest and now I live in the Rocky Mountains. And, you know, guess what? It's not flat here. And I remember like the first time I went down a hill that scared the dickens out of me. I mean, I'm thinking about it and my feet started to sweat. Mm. And I went down the hill and I'm like, and I made it down. And the first thing I wanted to do was ski right back up and do it again because it felt so good. Not just because I survived, not just because it was fun, but I felt good about it. Is there something that people can do to intentionally tap into that for themselves?
Come visit you and go skiing.
And I'm always open to that.
So there's a couple of things. One is there's some really interesting research about stress. And Kelly McGonigal wrote a book about this called The Upside of Stress. And we have some really nice articles about this on 6seconds.org. But when we think about stress, the physiological effects of distress are things like accelerating heart rate, closing of your capillaries, more rapid breathing, more focused attention, more agitation. If you think about yourself just before you went down that hill, you had the identical physiological reaction.
Yes.
So the physiological reaction between excitement and stress are almost the same.
Really?
Down to the neurohormones that we release. And so there's a fascinating study that Kelly McGonigal talks about, where basically all they did is they said to heart patients, when you feel stressed, ask yourself what's exciting you about the situation.
Wow.
30% less death.
Seriously.
30% less death from heart disease. So that little shift to how are we explaining, what is the story we're telling about our experience?
Yep.
In grief, one of the stages or one of the tools is meaning making, right?
Yeah.
We start to say, well, like this terrible thing happened and it doesn't make it okay, but I learned something, or I'm going to use this to help the world in some way. That's meaning making.
Yeah.
The meaning we make, the story that we tell about our experience changes the meaning of it.
That's right.
And so when you're standing on that hill and you're saying, I'm going to die, this is horrible, you're making one meaning. When you're standing
there,
you have the identical physiological reaction and you're saying, wow, this is challenging. I'm going to learn something.
Yeah. Wow. Because that's how I approach it now.
Yeah.
You know, every time I approach a new hill that's scarier than the last one, it's like, well, number one, look at all the other ones I've done.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm still here to talk about it. But it's like, but it kind of shifted my, I don't know if it shifted my identity, but it shifted the way the story I told myself. Because before I was a timid skier and I avoided hills. And now it's like, no, I conquer tough hills and I learn when I do so. That's really, man, excitement and stress. And what'd you say? It's the same
physiological reaction. Our bodies react to these two things in almost identical ways.
Wow. That's really cool.
So I would say the other thing is we make a lot of assumptions about, we feel things. Feelings are very short term. And, you know, I've spent 24 years trying to make friends with feelings and I see value in them. And I understand these are very short term friends. They're like, look at this. Yeah. Right? So there's this piece about how do I get a longer lens during the first part of the pandemic that feels like it was 10 years ago.
Doesn't it though?
I was feeling a lot of distress, as I think a lot of us were. And I'm somebody who really likes having plans and knowing what's happening. And, you know, I plan my calendar 2 years out, right? And I'm like really good at budgets and like all that stuff. And I don't know, I think a lot of us experienced this, but I had a lot of calls with people, employees, colleagues saying, you know, what's going to happen? How are we going to do this? Am I going to have a job?
Yeah.
And, you know, the number of times I was saying, I don't know, it was really painful. And I had a conversation with the director of 6 Seconds China, Natalie Reutemann, and she said, I've been thinking about this question that you asked me before, and I think maybe it would be helpful, which is when you look back at this situation 5 years from now, who do you want to be?
Wow.
And that just like shifted.
Yeah. That is a great question.
And thinking about like in that moment in the early pandemic, like, okay, whether the business closes or not, who do I want to be in this moment? How do I want to be able to look back at myself 5 years from now and say, well, you know, X, Y, and Z happened, but I was this.
Yes.
You know, and for me, it was, I am supporting people. I'm staying engaged. I'm finding optimism, which doesn't mean pretending everything's fine.
No.
I'm connecting. I'm supporting. And that gave me a place to stand in this kind of uncertainty.
Yeah, that is, I love that question, Josh. I mean, that's a powerful question.
Well, and Bobby, you know, in the 6 Seconds model of emotional intelligence, we have these three parts of the model. Like, how do you practice emotional intelligence? And there are these three steps. And this is really about that third step.
Yeah.
About connecting beyond yourself. So the first step is tuning in and getting data. And like I said, like, okay, let's understand this. Let's figure this out. The second step is to stop and say, okay, I don't need to react. I can open up the possibilities. I can think about the story that I'm telling and find other stories. And then the third step is to connect beyond yourself, beyond this moment. Okay, what really matters here?
Yeah.
And this question of who do you want to be when you look back at this 5 years from now, that's a way of connecting beyond yourself.
Yeah. The third one, the connecting beyond yourself. Would you speak to that one a little bit more?
So there's two competencies in this part of the model. One is increasing empathy, which is about emotional connection, not just empathizing, right? So I can empathize with you. It's kind of like trying to direct my empathy towards you. Increasing empathy is for both of us. There's a mutuality in it. And when I really work on increasing empathy, I am also feeling the power of that connection. And so that's kind of enlarging that sense of human connectedness. And then the second one we call pursue noble goals. And it's about thinking about what's really important for you and how the pursuit of that is about how do you bring that into this moment.
Interesting.
And this, if you think about on a neurobiological level, this is true as well, but we can think about it in a more kind of philosophical level. Gandhi talked about this idea that we're always adding to the world. And there's a rather overused quote, which is, you know, be the change you want to see in the world. This is where this comes from. You're always contributing, you're always affecting. When you change your thoughts, when you change your feelings, when you change your actions, you're changing a part of the world. Just a tiny, tiny bit, but that's your bit. And so then the question is, Gandhi said there's no difference between the means and the ends. So, you know, Machiavelli said, like, do whatever you want as long as the ends are good. Gandhi said, no, if you want peace, do peace.
Yeah.
So what are you putting in the world right now that's going to add up to legacy? And so this idea of pursuing noble goals is about saying, okay, what is it that I really want to add in the world? What's one little bit of it I can do right now?
Yeah, I love that. And breaking it down to what is the little bit I can do right now versus my, it's so far out there. Okay, so I had this experience last week, and I think it connects to this. I had decided we're going to do a video course. And I'm used to being a speaker and a trainer in front of groups, even over WebEx, that's one thing, or over Zoom. But to just do a video course where you've only got the video, it's tough.
Right, and you have to look into the camera.
The whole time, it's like, can I blink? Is it okay if I blink? I don't know. And then you get in front of the camera and you're like, oh, I don't like the lighting. I don't like my hair and all this kind of stuff, you know, all that chatter that goes on. And I remember I just thought to myself, I'm like, wait a minute, someone out there needs what you're about to do. So get over yourself and do it. And Josh, it was like a switch because I kept thinking, no, this is uncomfortable for me, but there's someone who needs this.
Right. So you connected
beyond
yourself.
Yeah.
And when you did that, that gave you a way to shift your emotions and your thoughts and your actions.
That's right. And it was so powerful. And I think that when we do that, when we shift away from ourselves, some of our own chatter, self-doubt, I think that can help us make that shift and take the action.
So I just want to be careful here, which is some people are going to hear this and go, okay, so I shouldn't feel self-doubt. I shouldn't feel worried. I shouldn't feel like you should. Those feelings are valuable. They're telling you
something. They are.
But they're not the boss of you. Right? So it's like, I'm going to listen to this. I'm going to get value from it, but I'm not going to let this one feeling be in charge.
Yeah.
We have all of these different feelings.
Yeah. Okay. So let me ask you this, because this comes up a lot. People are always like, oh, why do I have fear? Why do I have self-doubt? Why do I fear failing? Why do I fear what other people think? You know, on. And I think we all have that. Why do we have it?
To protect us.
Yeah.
To help us clarify what's really important.
Yeah.
To challenge us to think more deeply.
Right.
So one of the things that I suspect is that a lot of times where we get stuck with feelings, it's because we haven't been listening. A lot of times people will say like, oh, I should be less emotional. And I actually think that probably, and this may be true for some people, maybe you should, but I think for most people, what really we need to do is be more emotional earlier. So let me give you an example
in
a workplace setting. So let's just say you're working with somebody and you're working on a project with them. I just had this happen and they do something that you don't really like. And so I feel annoyed. And my first thing is just to push that aside and go, okay, just get over yourself, be nice, you know, whatever. Like, and so I ignore the feeling and I don't address it. And then 2 weeks later, same thing happens again, maybe a little worse. And I'm like, okay, but just put that aside. Let's just, let's just get on with work. Right. And then 2 weeks later, it happens again. What is going on here? Why is this like?
Then it's an explosion.
Right. And they're like, whoa, what happened? Like, why didn't you tell me?
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's a really fair question. Why didn't I tell you?
Yeah.
Why didn't I tune into this 4 weeks ago when I first noticed it? Yeah. So I think if we can be like a little more finely tuned, we can like get our focus a little sharper with our emotions and actually pay attention to them when they're smaller. It's going to be a lot easier to deal with them and they can guide us and help us find our way. But if we do, you know, what I did in this story, we're pushing them away, and they kind of build up and then it's like really hard to handle.
Yeah. I think every single one of us has a story just like that one.
I'm afraid so.
It's like, it's almost always better to have the conversation earlier before it becomes this explosion that we...
And how many times have we all made decisions and then later said, you know what? I knew this was not the right choice. I felt it. I knew that I needed to do X, but I went along and did Y. You know, and that's like, yeah, we needed to be more emotional. We needed to respect our emotions more. Respect that wisdom of those feelings saying, wait a minute, are you sure?
Yeah.
Right. And it's, again, it's not that the feeling is the boss. The feeling is an advisor.
Ooh, I love that.
And respect that advisor and go, oh, look, I'm paying you a lot, my internal coach. You know, I should pay attention to what you're saying and like, think about it. I don't have to obey, but maybe I do need to think about it.
Yeah. Well, Josh, that reminds me when you said that the emotions and wisdom, you had an article on LinkedIn, I don't know how long ago it was, and it might've been a video, but it was the connection between emotions and wisdom. And can you share a little bit more about that connection? Yeah.
So part of what that was about is trying to understand ways of knowing that come from other cultures, that come from other traditions than our own. as a way of expanding the range of possibilities that we have for understanding ourselves and each other. And so we did a live stream about wisdom and emotions and diverse perspectives. And one of the challenges is we all grow up in a particular set of identities and perspectives, and it becomes very hard for us to really value the perspective of people who come from a different tradition. And so kind of confronting that there is a cultural lens that tells us what success is. There's a cultural lens that tells us even what wisdom is, and that we can expand that.
Yeah.
And we can notice that we have a bias about that. So one of the ways that we can expand our, I don't know, you can't really expand a lens. we can use multiple lenses is that emotions can give us clues to say, oh, there's something interesting here. Let me examine this. I'm having some big feelings. Maybe my big feelings are the result of a cultural bias, or maybe these big feelings are the result of a deeper truth. And how do we tell which of those it is there's not an easy answer to that. But I think it's an essential question for us to say, am I reacting this way? You know, this person said this thing. Am I reacting to them because of my bias? Am I reacting to them because they're different than me? Because that they frame things or see things different? Because their understanding of success is different than mine?
Yeah.
Or is it because this is really not right for me? And I don't think there's a formula for that. But what I think there is a way to step back and say, let me just check this out.
Yeah. It reminds me of what you were saying earlier with, you know, slowing down and tuning in.
Yeah.
You know, that automatic kind of knee-jerk type reaction.
So this goes back to this thing about the fairy tales of, you know, management, fairy tales of leadership. One of the fairy tales is that leaders are fast.
Yeah.
Decisive. You know, and this is like 1950s, you know, John Wayne leadership, like, oh, you got to draw your, you know, six shooter fast. That makes you a leader, right? There may be a few situations in our lives where that's true. There are a lot of situations in our lives where that's not true.
Yeah.
And this kind of, you know, tough man sort of view of leadership, that's a fairy tale that we get caught up in. And not just men, by the way, but we have this story in our heads of what it means to be a strong leader. And one of the things that we associate with being a strong leader is being fast and decisive.
Yeah.
And I think that undermines our ability to actually listen and find more creative solutions.
Yeah. When you were speaking there, what came to mind for me is the fast, the decisive, and like we don't change our minds. Even if you get started and all the data, everything is pointing to, maybe we need to adjust here. You know, it's like, I made the decision, so we're going that way.
Yeah. A senior leader said something in a room that I was in, which was, well, as soon as you apologize, you've lost.
Oh, man.
I was like, wow. What? That frame of like, that frame really narrows the possibility of learning.
Yeah. That's an interesting lens. see things and operate from. Wow.
And for me, I like my vision of leadership is about learning and growth.
Yeah.
And so for me saying, wow, I got more data and I figured out that I was wrong before and I'm going to make it better now. Like to me, that's leadership.
Yeah. And but oh my goodness.
For him, it sure it wasn't. Isn't.
Wow. I mean, that's a hard line. Okay, so I want to make sure I respect your time. There's one thing I have to ask you about, and that is when you hear people say you need to control your emotions.
Mm. Yeah. So again, I think that often that comes from not attending to emotions when they're small.
Oh.
And I use the metaphor sometimes of a train. And you know how when the train leaves the station, it starts, you know, chug, 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 and it gets going faster.
Yeah.
Or, you know, a snowball rolling down one of those mountains outside your window. But it's the momentum builds up. And I think most of the time, I need to control my emotions means I am not dealing with them when they're small. They get big, and then it becomes very difficult.
Yeah.
And so, again, the first step to that is to say, stop thinking of emotions as something negative. Tune in when they're small, find the value in it, deal with it, and then they're not going to escalate in the same way.
Yeah, that's great. And I love the metaphor of the train. So I used to, when I lived in Chicago, I took the commuter train out of the station. Yeah. And every day, like you're getting started, it's like, you could just feel like that chug.
Yeah, you feel the momentum, chug, right?
Yeah. And then pretty soon you're going at a good pace. But man, it'd be a lot easier to stop when you're just those first few chugs.
So when my kids were little, my wife and I would say, oh, you're on the trouble train. And so I actually wrote an article about this. So it's intended about parenting and kids, but I think it applies for all of us. So if you want to check that out on sixseconds.org, just search for trouble train.
Trouble train. Oh my goodness. I'm going to have to. The other thing I want to do is put that in the show notes. I also want to put in some of the articles on the stress that you mentioned earlier. So maybe later we can connect on that and I'll put those right in the show notes. Cause I think if people are interested, those are valuable resources. And you have a ton of resources there.
Yes.
You do. And it's awesome. With that in mind, would you tell people a little bit more about where they can find some of that? And I know you've got multiple books and
yeah.
Yeah.
So one thing is, for those of you who are managers, I really encourage you to look at the case studies, because I think a lot of times people hear about emotional intelligence and they think, that's good for me. That's good for me as an individual, but I don't quite understand how that creates organizational value.
Oh.
And so we worked hard to collect a lot of case studies, sixseconds.org/cases. And we have cases from Siemens and FedEx and the U.S. Navy and lots of different businesses and nonprofits and schools and individuals. And those case studies will help you see how this becomes part of leadership, how it becomes part of customer interaction, how it becomes part of building culture, and that emotional intelligence is actually something valuable for you as an organizational leader. The other thing is, we have a pretty active YouTube channel if you like videos. And then on social media, you can look up 6 seconds, on whatever social media you use. But if you're interested in going deeper, then I suggest you talk to Bobby and other coaches who are trained by 6 seconds. We have assessment tools for individuals and teams and organizations. And we have a whole methodology and curriculum around integrating emotional intelligence in building a strong, high-performing team organization.
Yeah. Just following you on LinkedIn too, Josh. You offer so much on LinkedIn, so much value.
Thank you.
Yeah, you really do. So this has been absolutely amazing. And I'll put those things in the show notes. Any final words before we wrap up?
So I have some bad news, which is we published the world's largest study on emotional intelligence. We've been tracking emotional intelligence since 2011. This year, we've started to release some of the findings already. And across 129 countries, in a random sampling methodology, we're seeing emotional intelligence declined a lot in 2020.
Really?
And, it's not that surprising when you think about what the last year's been like.
Yeah.
It's much harder to connect beyond ourselves. It's much harder to have space to breathe. It's much harder to kind of expand our attention. We're facing tremendous pressures.
Yeah.
Every person who walks in your door is carrying more rocks in their backpack than they were a couple years ago. You're carrying more rocks in your backpack. And what this says is, as a manager, as a friend, as a parent, as just a human being walking down the street, the people around you and you are carrying a heavier burden, and we need to help each other.
Yeah. The picture of the rocks in the backpack. Yeah.
This is really the time.
Yeah.
And we know from research on trauma and post-traumatic stress, we know that actually it's not in the middle of crisis that the real struggle arises. It's actually afterwards. And so just for example, it was a couple of years after Hurricane Katrina that the real mental health effects of the hurricane were at their peak. This isn't going to go away when we can just, go back to school and go back to work.
No.
The trauma of these, whether it's micro trauma or macro trauma of these 18 months, it's going to take some time and some work to heal from that. And we can do it.
Yeah.
We can learn these skills and we can practice and we can connect with each other and we can support each other, but it will not happen by itself. And so this is the time for us to do this work.
Yeah. Where does that work start?
It starts inside each of us.
Yeah. I thought that was going to be the answer, Josh.
starts inside each of us saying, okay, I'm going to pay more attention to my feelings. They're not going to be in charge of me, but I am going to listen. I'm going to tune in, and then I'm going to expand my choices. I'm going to tell the right story. I'm going to use them in a way that's helpful to me, and I'm going to connect beyond myself.
Yeah.
Do that over and over and over and over again, and you are practicing emotional intelligence, and it makes a difference.
It makes a huge difference. That is really sobering news that it's actually gone down and right when we need it the most.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Josh, thank you so much for being, I feel like this was just a masterclass. So thank you so much.
I'm so grateful for the opportunity to share and to meet new people and help people think about their emotions and make friends with those feelings, even the tough ones.
Nice. Wow. I don't know about you, but that felt like a masterclass. It is always so energizing for me when I'm talking to someone who's truly living their purpose. This is going to be a challenge to keep it limited to three, but here are my three insights for thriving. Number one, emotions are like a train leaving the station. When something happens, deal with the emotion when it's small, when they're just leaving the station, before the train has picked up speed and momentum. I loved Josh's approach. One, don't judge the emotion as good, bad, positive, or negative. It is merely data. It just is. Number two, tune into and find the value that it can provide. What can it tell you? And number three, then take intentional action. Insight number two, our brains love oversimplification and certainty. We actually get a dopamine reward for being right, which I think, or I wonder, is why we sometimes get a little stuck there and why maybe we continue doing the things that we've always done, even when we have that voice inside of us saying that maybe there's something more. We also get a dopamine reward for trying something new and learning something new, and that's exciting for me. So maybe the awareness of that reward when we try something new, maybe that can create a pulling effect for us that will help us break through our old ceilings. And number three, I loved the conversation about how we have narratives, which are kind of really like fairy tales. But I think that we believe the narratives as though they are truth. The problem is when we don't measure up to the narrative. Then we can become wrapped in self-doubt. And when we feel self-doubt, we think, what is wrong with me that I have doubt? The answer? Absolutely nothing. It means that you are human. This is where, for me, when I tune into how what I'm about to do is going to benefit others, that self-doubt fades a little bit. It never completely goes away, but it kind of recedes to the corner and it becomes a little quieter. I was talking to someone just the other day, and he said to me, it seems as though you never have any self-doubt. And I just laughed out loud because trust me, I have doubts and fears. I have a lot of them. They just don't boss me around. And related to that, I loved it when Josh said that our feeling isn't the boss. It's the advisor. We can listen and we can still choose because at the end of the day, we are still the boss of ourselves. And you probably knew this was coming, but I just couldn't help myself. I could not stick to three this time. So here is one bonus insight. I think that the question that Josh shared is such a powerful one that we could probably all apply at different times in our lives. And the question was this: when you look back at this situation 5 years from now, who do you want to be in this moment? That to me is a journal-worthy question. I'm not always a fan of big questions like that, but that one, that's worth noting and spending some time journaling about. So that's our show for today. I hope that you enjoyed it, and I hope you found great value in it. If you did, be sure to hit that subscribe button so that you never miss an episode. And this week, I'm going to shamelessly steal Josh's question and leave you with this. Whatever your situation is right now, when you look back at this moment 5 years from now, who do you want to be in this moment?